The headlines: Iran holds the third day of large-scale military drills in the Persian Gulf region, showcasing its latest defense capabilities. Libya's Electoral Commission says it's impossible to hold the presidential election scheduled for Friday, proposing a one-month postponement. And tensions are rising between the European Union and two of its members, namely Poland and Hungary, over judicial and migration rules. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps holds the third day of large-scale military drills in the south of the country. The IGC's ground forces successfully performed offensive and defensive operations using new military weapons, equipment, and modern techniques. The forces hit identified targets with heavy and semi-heavy weapons after receiving intelligence on hypothetical enemy. An advanced homegrown tank capable of withstanding heat waves was used for the first time. The five-day maneuvers are codenamed the Great Prophet 17. They are carried out in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz regions, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The drills involve a variety of IRGC units. Iran regularly holds military drills to enhance the combat readiness of its armed forces. Earlier we were joined by journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khoshesh. He explains why the ongoing military drills in Iran are significant and what message they send.
Well, you know that the Great Prophet series of drills are routine exercises that happen annually. But now, in this time, it's sending direct messages to the Americans, to the Israelis, and to those Western powers in the Vienna talks that have been trying to, blackmail Iran through military threats by the Israeli regime and the bathtub Gutkov game that they started right from the beginning, or even before the beginning of the Vienna talks. In some kind of demarcation dispute, the Israelis and Americans, they've been, picking up the roles of the good cup and bad cup in the Vienna talks, trying to give credibility to military threats against Iran that was lost actually after the Iranian missile strike on Ain al-Assad in down of Global Hog and many other, scenes in the Persian Gulf. And as they started the talks, they tried to appoint or assign the Israelis to this backup role, but the Israeli regime has failed already in playing a convincing role since went to the extremes. It radicalized the tone of the threats in quantity and quality.
The Iraqi judicial team is in Iran to continue an investigation into the assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The late commander was killed in a U.S. drone strike in 2019. Yusuf Jalali has more.
This is the second time Iranian and Iraqi judicial experts convened to publicize their probe into the assassination of top Iranian military figure, General Qasem Soleimani. Soleimani was the commander of IRGC's Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He, together with commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was killed in 2019 in a U.S. air raid outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump.
Our Iraqi judicial colleagues have maintained close cooperation with our team. Iraq is where the crime occurred, and the Iraqi government and judiciary are as resolute as we are in prosecuting the perpetrators. Since we formed the Joint Iran-Iraq Committee to investigate the incident, the process has been sped up, and hopefully we will complete and file our lawsuit in international courts within the next 3 months.
In November, Iraq hosted the first session of the Joint Committee on General Soleimani's assassination. Based on the latest findings of the legal team, 120 people have been identified in connection with the matter. U.S. President Donald Trump tops the list. Iran's judiciary says, aside from penalizing the culprits, it is taking steps to have those involved in the matter compensate for the damages inflicted to the families of the victims.
Iran and Iraq are both determined to find and punish those who are directly or indirectly involved in the assassination of General Soleimani. And this is not going to be limited to the domestic legal systems of the two countries. We will take the case to the international courts. There were countries other than the U.S. which were also engaged in the crime.
General Soleimani holds a reputation for eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also headed major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. The United States killed the nemesis of Daesh, and this puts Washington on the terrorist team. Now the Islamic Republic says it continues its legal pursuit to bring the perpetrators to justice, saying this is to make sure that such incidents will not happen again against its military figures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Reports coming out of Iraq suggest an attack on a U.S. logistics convoy in the south of that country. Iraqi media say multiple roadside bombs targeted the convoy in Mutahana governorate. Still, no report of casualties or possible damage. American troops, as well as their military and logistics convoys, have repeatedly come under attack over the past year. The attacks escalated after the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the senior Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in January 2020. The killings gave a rise to calls for the expulsion of American forces from Iraq. Earlier this month, the U.S. ended its combat mission there and limited it to an advisory one. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas slams new Israeli rules that give the regime's soldiers more freedom to use deadly force against Palestinians. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam says the new Israeli rules show the true face of the Zionist regime. He says the rules also show Israeli military leaders' criminal behaviors that are based on terrorism and the deliberate killing of the innocent people. The Hamas official says the new laws indicate that the Israeli regime is confused and is frightened in the face of the courage of the Palestinian people. The Israeli military announced a change to its open fire rules in the occupied West Bank earlier this week. The new regulations allow Israeli soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones even if they don't pose an imminent threat. Just 2 days ahead of a much-awaited presidential election in Libya, the Electoral Commission says that it's impossible to hold the vote on Friday, proposes pushing back the vote by a month. In a letter to the Libyan Parliament Speaker, the Commission said it took the decision after consulting the technical, judicial, and security reports. The delay was widely anticipated amid disputes over the election rules, including those on who should run for president. Figures deemed as divisive had announced their candidacies. They included Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, son of former ruler Muammar Gaddafi, who was toppled in an uprising in 2011. Another controversial figure was General Khalifa Haftar, who led a 2019 conflict against the UN-backed Libyan government in Tripoli. That conflict was ended by last year's ceasefire. Now there are fears that delaying the presidential vote could affect the peace process. The European Union launches legal action against Poland, accusing the country of undermining the independence of Polish judges. Brussels says the rulings of the Polish Constitutional Tribunal breach the general principles of autonomy and the primacy of EU law. The bloc also claims the powerful Polish court is depriving individuals of the right to effective judicial protection. Poland is critical of the EU's decision, slamming it as an attack on its sovereignty. Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki says an increasing number of EU countries think there should be a distinction between what the bloc and member states deal with. Poland's Constitutional Tribunal had ruled in October that Polish laws took precedence over EU laws. Meanwhile, tensions between Hungary and the European Union reaching new highs. Budapest says it won't change its migration policy despite a ruling from the EU's top court. Prime Minister Viktor Orban says the ruling is in contradiction with the EU's own law that Hungary will keep its current system of border protection. Hungary has passed a law that seeks to combat illegal migration by criminalizing lawyers and activists who help migrants. Last month, the EU's High Court ruled that the law was illegal, but the refusal to comply with the EU court decision has been costly for Hungary. The bloc has moved to penalize the country by blocking its coronavirus recovery funds. And that, in turn, has drawn a strong criticism from Hungary's leader.
The EU has no legal right to keep the payments and the participation in the RFF EU's recovery and resilience facility from Hungary or any other member states. The RFF is the result of a common decision. The EU takes money from the international financial markets on our behalf as well.
Orbán called the EU's move to withhold pandemic funds, quote, a brutal sabotage. His government is known for its anti-immigration agenda. For years, the EU and Hungary have been at loggerheads over a range of issues, including judicial independence and refugee rights. Budapest accuses Brussels of working against the country's national interests and meddling in its internal affairs. Let's talk about this with Jerome Hughes, who joins us. What exactly is the EU jurisdiction in which it's getting such a pushback?
Well, Cavi, there's no doubt that there are growing divisions within the European Union, and this relates to the rise of the far right. And we've been hearing from analysts now for years. They say that this is the single biggest threat to the future of the European Union when you have Eurosceptic parties coming into power. And what they also say is that we can talk about many times about Hungary and Poland and Czech Republic, but we also see a rise of the far right in countries like France. Now, we have elections coming up in France starting in April. And what the commentators have been saying is that the EU can survive and push back against these smaller nations within the bloc in terms of their power. But actually, if it comes to the point where we have the far right getting into power in a country like France, that would be absolutely devastating because France is one of the kingpins of the European Union. It's one of the pillars. So this is a trend that's going in the wrong direction for the European Union. But you talk about new developments in terms of decisions taken by, the courts in Poland or the parliaments in Hungary or whatever. But these are issues. They're nothing new. We've been talking about this now for years. In countries like Poland and Hungary and the Czech Republic, there is a pushback against the rule of law. So we're talking about judicial independence, we're talking about media freedoms, we're talking about the treatment of minority groups. For example, the situation with refugees, where Hungary has made it clear it just simply will not take in any more refugees. And the point has been made as well, we use the word hypocrisy with the European Union. The EU itself, the European Commission, has a lot of powers that it could take against these countries. Now, you mentioned about legal action beginning. They call these infringement procedures. But these procedures can take years to actually come to effect. And it turns out that very often these legal actions are taken by the European Commission and they come to nothing. But actually, when the European Commission and the EU itself wants to take action against other countries, most recently we could talk about Belarus, they're able to introduce sanctions almost overnight. So actually, it is a case that the EU is not willing to take action against its own member states, but it's very quick to take action against other member states. So that word hypocrisy comes into play again. And I've just been reading a statement from the European Trade Union Confederation, the ETUC. This is the umbrella body for all of the trade unions, workers' unions in the EU. So we're talking about representing millions of people here. And they've released a very hard-hitting statement. They talk about the fact that when we had the leaders' summit last Thursday here in Brussels, and it went on into Friday, there wasn't one mention, there wasn't one statement from the EU leaders or from the European Commission and the European Council at the end of the summit in relation to the treatment of refugees. Look at the way Poland was treating migrants along its borders, and no condemnation about this, no action about this. So again, it's down to the situation that the European Commission, elements of the EU, some EU countries can criticise Viktor Orban and Poland and Czech Republic and to a certain extent Austria and so on, but actually no action is really taken. And so there's just this sort of the contradiction and hypocrisy that continues to play out.
Thank you very much for that. It's a pleasure. Jerome Hughes, a correspondent there from Brussels. Many thanks. Following weeks of simmering tensions over Ukraine, Russia and the West are now preparing to sit down to resolve the differences.
It has been agreed that at the very beginning of next year, the first round of talks should be bilateral contact between our negotiators and American ones. We plan in the foreseeable future, we also want to do this in January, to use the negotiating platform to discuss the second document, the draft agreement between Russia and NATO.
Lavrov says the planned talks will revolve around the demands that Russia has presented to the U.S. and NATO last week. In its draft documents, Russia has called for security guarantees that its neighbors will not receive certain offensive weapons. Moscow has also demanded NATO halt its eastward expansion. Russia, at the same time, has warned the West of a tough response unless it drops its aggressive line. The West accuses Russia of preparing a war in Ukraine and says that Moscow would see severe consequences. Russia denies any such plan. France is fighting a fifth wave of the coronavirus pandemic as authorities raise the alarm about the fast spread of the Omicron variant. Health Minister Olivier Véran warns that the daily infections could soon reach around 100,000. He says by early January, Omicron will be the dominant strain in France. The country has registered nearly 73,000 cases in the past 24 hours. About one-fifth are linked to Omicron. But authorities say for now, no new restrictions are on the table. They're hoping to tackle the current surge with tougher vaccine rules, including more restrictions for the unvaccinated. France is among many European countries witnessing a wave of infections caused by a rise in the spread of Omicron. Dozens of people are missing after a landslide at a jade mine in northern Myanmar. It happened in Pakhant town in Kachin State, the country's major jade mining area, in the early morning hours. Rescue teams say that one person is dead and about 100 are missing, many of whom were swept away into a nearby lake by mining waste. The search and rescue operation is underway in the area. Myanmar supplies up to 90% of the world's jade, and Pakhant mines draw poor workers looking for gems mostly for exports to China. But the industry is known for deadly accidents. 6 people died last week, and about 200 miners lost their lives in Myanmar's deadliest ever mining accident last year. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
At the end of the day, the US-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article published under the heading Biden administration's reluctance to spend geopolitical capital greenlights Israeli settlement push. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime bowed to American pressure and scrapped the controversial Atarot settlement in the Palestinian neighborhood of Ghalandia, just north of Al-Quds. But on the heels of that decision, the regime advanced another Jewish settlement in Palestinian neighborhoods along Al-Quds' southern tip, even as the residents there are grappling with a severe housing shortage. The plan is to develop a new neighborhood called Givat HaShaked on land expanding beyond the Green Line, the Zionist regime's de facto border. Before the 1967 war, which saw it occupy its Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, and adjacent to the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa in occupied East Al-Quds. Recently, the Al-Quds Municipality Planning and Building Committee recommended the development plan for the deposit, meaning it will now head to Al-Quds District Planning Committee, which will decide whether to deposit the plan for objections or public review. The project calls for construction of 473 homes, schools, and synagogues to be built on about 9 acres of open land. During the committee hearing, the Zionist regime's custodian general, the authority within the Justice Ministry overseeing properties whose owners are unknown, was represented by its economic unit director, Hanel Gorfinkel. Gorfinkel is a right-wing activist known for supporting Jewish settlement in East Al-Quds. Givat HaShaked is not the only settlement in East Al-Quds being pushed by the custodian general. Documentation obtained by Haaretz reveals Givat HaShaked is one of 6 Jewish neighborhoods the Zionist regime is currently advancing across East Al-Quds. These include one in Sheikh Jarrah, one near Damascus Gate, one in Sor Bahar, one in Beit Haniya, and another in Beit Safafa. Activists emphasize that Gorfinkel's appointment is directly intertwined with the heightened settlement activity and the displacement of Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Al-Quds-focused Israeli human rights organization Er Amim, said of Gorfinkel, "What we have seen is that since his appointment in 2017, there has been a substantial increase in eviction lawsuits against Palestinians and the expansion of Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas." According to Er Amim, the acreage set for Givat HaShaked is actually on land that is undergoing formal land registration in Sharafat area of Beit Safafa. The Zionist regime's 2018 decision 3790 was marketed to the public as a means to push economic development in East Al-Quds and reduce socioeconomic inequality. The initiative reserved 50 million shekels, nearly $16 million, for the registration of land rights in East Al-Quds, an important prerequisite needed to secure building permits. The Zionist regime authorities often use the absence of building permits as justification for demolishing Palestinian homes. However, as uncovered by Er Amim, land registration procedures are being used to advance Jewish settlement as found in Sheikh Jarrah, rather than develop Palestinian neighborhoods in Al-Quds. On one hand, Decision 3790 is depicted as a tool to aid Palestinians, Cohen told Min Press News, adding, "And yet it's being used to further the expansion of Jewish settlement and confiscation of Palestinian land and property. Land registration is supposed to be a transparent and publicized process," Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner at Israeli Regime Planning Rights Organization BIMCOM, explained. "The regime is supposed to publish a map of areas of the plots and invite people to make claims. And if claims are made that contradict each other, then the registrar is supposed to send those claims to court to be clarified," Kronish said, adding, "But the way the regime is actually doing it, we see that it's being done quietly. People often don't know that's happening. We don't know yet of a single case where the Palestinians will be able to benefit from it," Kronish added. Thank you. the area reserved for Givat Hashaket was once sought after for development by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In 1995, Rabin put forward a housing project for the land, sparking international outcry. The UN Security Council voted to have the Zionist regime halt the plan, with the United States vetoing the resolution. Rabin shelved his expropriation days after the UN vote in what has been speculated to be an exchange for the US veto. Now the current Zionist regime is going beyond what any previous leadership dared to. Daniel Scheidman, founder and director of Israeli nonprofit Terrestrial Al-Quds, emphasized. These settlement plans are now on the agenda, Scheidman told Min Press News, adding relations between the United States and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are charged at the moment. Scheidman continued, the Americans have made their concerns very clear about the settlement of E1 and Atarot, so why is Bennett having another poke in the eye over something like this? Lara Friedman, president of the American Nonprofit Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP, agreed the new government is stepping into territory even Bennett's predecessor wouldn't touch. They are as bad as the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, and in many ways, they are worse, Friedman said, adding, these settlements are absolutely incompatible with any commitment to anything other than permanent Israeli control over the entire area, Friedman added, highlighting the record number of home demolitions throughout Area C of the occupied West Bank as another way Bennett's cabinet is pushing increased annexation. From Er Amim's Cohen's perspective, despite Bennett's cabinet being a politically diverse coalition, hardline voices are the ones in power. Far-right members of the coalition are put in very strategic high-level positions like in the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Justice, Cohen said. All of these portfolios are very senior and they have a lot of weight. And what we have seen is because of this, they're quietly able to advance this very far-right-wing agenda. Prominent right-wing politicians hold top spots in Israel's cabinet. Ayelet Shaked is Interior Minister. Zeev Elkin is the Minister of Housing and Construction. And Gideon Saar serves as the Minister of so-called Justice. As settlement expansion becomes the defining feature of Bennett's regime, the other side of the Atlantic is becoming increasingly more vocal about the Zionist occupation and land theft. In November 26, U.S. House Democrats penned a letter urging Secretary of State Antony Blinken to stop the Zionist regime from moving forward with a settlement plan in E1 area of the West Bank. The move was led by Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who recently toured a Palestinian village in the West Bank with New York Representative Jamal Bowman. And Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum has become a strong advocate for Palestinian rights in Congress. The Democrat has sponsored two bills related to U.S. military aid to the Zionist regime and said the state practices apartheid. On the Givat HaShaket proposal, an ongoing settlement expansion in Palestine, McCollum told Min Press in a statement, the Zionist regime's state-sponsored expansion of settlements on Palestinian land, while the Israeli cabinet bureaucrats deny Palestinian permits to even build homes and bulldoze existing Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses, is destroying the prospect of a Palestinian state and the prospects for peace. The global community views the Israeli settlement expansion as illegal and lethal to any future peace process. and the U.S. government should not be silent. The situation has reached a point in which the Palestinians are clearly a people denied even basic human rights while under Israeli regime subjugation. U.S. lawmakers are emerging as more and more critical of Israeli regime, but that hasn't stopped the Israeli regime violence. In fact, the Zionist regime appears almost fueled by the condemnation. But at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights. No U.S. administration wants to be perceived as picking 10 fights every day with Israel, even if Israel is engaging every day in 10 things that really demand a response from the U.S.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagin.
We've been discussing the matter of the emotional connection with Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and the importance of it, and what it is, and how to improve that, how to increase that relationship. Tonight, what I want to discuss is related to what she does with that emotional relationship with us. Meaning, a relationship is, as we tried to explain last night, in terms of how to develop that relationship closer with Fatima al-Zahra, we said it's a real relationship, and she's the other side of that relationship. She is a real person above our understanding, but she is a person present, involved, able. The other side of that relationship is us. She is one side, and we are the other side of that relationship. We do certain things to develop that relationship. Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, what about her in this relationship? What does she do? Is she involved in this relationship? Is it a real relationship, or is it just me trying to, again, when we look at it the wrong way, we think of having this imagination, really, it's in our heads. We're thinking of this person. It's just a thought, a concept in our heads. And we are talking about making a connection to that thought, really. If that thought is not a thought, if it's a person, if they're real, if they're there, and it's a relationship, then it's a two-way relationship. If I'm trying to get a closer connection, a closer emotional relationship with Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, and she's a real person, and she's involved, and she is able, then she's able to see that. She's able to see that a person is trying to make that relationship with her. She is able to see that we are trying to deepen that relationship with her. We're trying to increase our emotional attachment to her. if it's real and she's real and she's involved in this relationship that we're trying to develop, what about on her end? Does she do anything regarding this relationship? Is she interested in this relationship? Is she involved in this relationship? Or is she, yeah, she's involved in my life, she's the context of Laylatul Qadr, and so she's so great, who am I? She doesn't even know who I am, she doesn't even know what I'm dealing with on a personal level, she's just given a task, let's say. These are thoughts that may come to mind, things that we need to get rid of and try to have a more clear understanding of her relationship with us. Is this how it is? Or is it that, no, when I am in contact with her, when I am having this relationship with her, she's a real person that is interested and involved in that relationship. In fact, perhaps, and we're going to talk about this and see if it's the case or not, that her involvement in the relationship is actually deeper than my involvement in that relationship with her. Her interest in bringing me closer to herself is more than my interest in getting closer to her and being closer to her. Which one of these two scenarios do we have? Is it the case that she's just there, she's a person, who am I? Yeah, we should look at ourselves. When we look at ourselves in this relationship, we should see that I'm really not worthy of anything. But while we have that, what about her? These are two different things. If she is attending to this relationship, if she is involved in this relationship, if she is caring for this relationship, it's not because I deserve it. These are two different things. We either go the route of saying, oh, you know, I deserve this. Why aren't you speaking to me? Why aren't you responding to me? Why aren't you this? Why aren't you that? Which means that I have an expectation, which means that I expect that I have an understanding of myself that I'm at a level that she should be attending to me. She should be caring for me. She should be wanting me to get closer to her and so on and so forth. That part we need to look more closely at and realize that honestly and really and truthfully, no, we're not. I am not, and none of us are. None of us are. Not because I'm putting anyone down. The reality of the matter is, none of us have anything to really be worthy of telling her that you need to and you're supposed to be involved in this. No, none of us can look at that. And this is not being humble in a superficial or an artificial, unreal way. No, sir, this is the reality. This is understanding who I am. Every one of us, understanding who we are. I don't deserve this. That being said, that being the case, that being a fact of the matter, what about on her side? Does she think that she needs to try to get me closer to her? Or is she careless? She sees us the way we see ourselves. And she sees us as nobodies. She looks at us in that way and she doesn't really care. Look, I have this task and is this how she is? What is her share in this relationship? This is what we want to discuss. And the reason why we're discussing this is in the context of our discussion. Let's not forget, our discussion, this Fatimiyya, is about how we can increase or how we should increase and just generally relating to our relationship with Fatimatu Zahra, our emotional relationship with Fatimatu Zahra. It has to do with our part in this. It has to do with our involvement in this. But one of the things that is going to help us in having a better relationship is our understanding of her part in this relationship. If we don't understand that, the way we're going to be dealing with this relationship is going to be different compared to when we know what her relationship is, what her part is, what does she do, what type of involvement does she have. And let's be real here, let's be serious here, let's be honest with ourselves. A lot of times we're either negligent of this, we're negligent of what the reality of what their part in the relationship, how they feel about us, how they deal with us. We're either negligent of it, God forbid we have wrong understandings of it.
أسعفيني بفيضك المعطاء
إنه سلمي إلى العلياء فامنحي نفحة الحياة يا سبيلي إلى النجاة يا طريقا إلى العلا زهراء يا طريقا إلى العلا
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
لك يا مولاتي نشأت كلماتي يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء يا وسيلتنا وشفيعتنا فاطم الزهراء
فاطم الزهراء.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. officials are sticking their heads into the sand of reality on Omicron. Unless they take needed steps, the results may be catastrophic. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Gleb Tapioski, writer. This article is titled, Omicron Reveals How U.S. Officials Stick Their Heads into the Sand of Reality. Stay tuned for more. U.S. officials are sticking their heads into the sand of reality on Omicron. Unless they take needed steps, the results may be catastrophic. Omicron is 4.2 times more infectious than Delta, according to a recent study that aligns with other estimates of 3 to 6 times greater infectivity. Still, surveys show that Omicron has had very little impact on the willingness of Americans to get a booster or even get a first vaccine dose. Yet, despite this very serious threat, we see the lack of meaningful leadership action. Scientists strongly believe that a major winter wave of Omicron is coming in the U.S. That's because of other countries where Omicron is spreading. U.S. genomic sequencing is much worse than other countries with similar cultures and climates, such as the U.K. It's detecting a doubling of Omicron cases every couple of days. The U.K. Health Authority called Omicron the most significant threat since the pandemic began. The country already had someone die with Omicron. Or consider Denmark, which has hit its highest case load of pandemic due to Omicron. Norway also has a very high COVID case growth rate for the same reason. The only silver lining is that Omicron so far appears to cause a milder illness than Delta. Yet the World Health Organization has warned about the mightness narrative. It noted that the unvaccinated or those vaccinated who are older or have underlying health conditions and don't have a booster are still at risk for severe disease and death. The much faster disease transmission and vaccine escape undercut the less severe overall nature of Omicron. That's why hospitals have a large probability of being overwhelmed, including in the U.S., as the Center for Disease Control warned. Yet despite this very serious threat, we see the lack of real action in the U.S. The federal government tightened international travel guidelines, which might have helped if Omicron wasn't already detected in over half of all states. It's exploring the possibility of Omicron-specific boosters, which would take at least 3 months to be approved, long after the Omicron wave sweeps over the U.S., but it's not taking the steps that would be the real game changers. We see even more problematic behavior at the state level. For example, Colorado Governor Jared Polis, a Democrat, declared the end of the medical emergency in recent interview, despite the rise of Omicron. Similarly, most companies are not pivoting effectively to meet Omicron. Some are bringing out the tired old delay the office reopening play. For example, Google, Uber, and Ford, along with many others, have delayed their return to the office for several months. Those that already returned are calling for stricter pandemic measures, such as more masks and social distancing, but not changing their work arrangements. You probably heard the quote, "The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results." Despite plenty of warnings from risk management and cognitive bias experts like Dr. Fauci, companies are repeating the same mistakes of failing to re-envision the future of work. That's despite numerous employees quitting because of the compulsive plans of their employers to get them back to the office as part of the Great Resignation. What explains this puzzling leadership behavior in the United States? U.S. officials and all of Americans are prone to falling for dangerous judgment errors called cognitive biases. Rooted in wishful thinking, these mental blind spots lead to poor strategic and financial decisions when evaluating choices. One of the biggest challenges relevant to the Omicron is the cognitive bias known as the ostrich effect, named after the myth that ostriches stick their heads into the sand when they fear danger. The ostrich effect refers to people denying negative reality. Delta illustrated the high likelihood of additional dangerous variants, yet the leadership in the U.S., a $1 trillion companies and the federal government denied the reality of this risk. The way forward into the future of work is to defeat cognitive biases and avoid denying reality by rethinking the approach to the future. For companies, instead of dictating a top-down approach to how employees collaborate, adopt a team-led approach where each individual team leader of a rank-and-file employee team determines what works best for the team. Integrate best practices for innovation, collaboration, and accountability for hybrid and remote teams, such as virtual asynchronous brainstorming. For governments, re-envision the kind of red tape involved in approval processes during emergency conditions and the kind of funding available for public health. It should be absolutely unacceptable that thousands of people are dying due to a month-long FDA approval process when the FDA's officials approved stopping Paxlovid's trial early. It should be absolutely unacceptable that people are spreading COVID to others because the government refuses to facilitate easy access to at-home COVID tests. And it should be absolutely unacceptable for high-level government officials to muddle the terrible message that COVID is over as a medical emergency. COVID will never go away. We need to learn to live with it. That means reacting appropriately and thoughtfully to new variants and being intentional about our trade-offs.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
سبک زندگی اسلامی در رفتار رزمندگان ما و شهدای ما یه چیز برجسته است که نمی‌شود از این صرف نظر کرد واقعا.
The Islamic lifestyle seen in the behavior of our soldiers and martyrs is too important to be disregarded. There are so many inspirational points to be seen in the lives of the martyrs that our artists should truly portray an artistic picture of this for the whole world. They should introduce the Iranian soldiers to the world. They should place our soldiers in front of the eyes of the people throughout the world with their great artistic works. Well, the commemoration ceremony that you have organized should open our ears to the message of the martyrs. They tell us the martyrs are rejoicing for those who have not yet joined them, from those left behind them, that they will not have any fear, nor will they grieve. The Holy Quran, Surah 3, verse 170. This path is one that is free from any fear, worry, and concern, because it is the path of God. We should be steadfast on this path and move with strength. We should not falter on this path with the temptations of the enemies.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
ملت ایران با شنیدن پیام شهیدان باید اتحاد خود، اتفاق خود، انگیزه خود، تلاش خود رو بیشتر کنه. پیام شهیدان ما اینه.
The Iranian nation should increase its unity, solidarity, motivation and efforts when it hears the martyrs' message. This is the message of the martyrs to us. When hearing the message of the martyrs, the officials of the Islamic Republic should feel more responsible towards society and ensure security in the way the martyrs did. Everyone should feel responsible. And all of us should pay attention to this fact that no nation will get anywhere without diligence, struggling in the way of God and enduring hardships. If there are any hardships, enduring those hardships will help the Iranian nation reach the peak. Inshallah, God willing. I hope that God, the Exalted, will bestow success on all of you, that He will grant His mercy and forgiveness to the dear martyrs of Ilam and all the martyrs of the country, that He will associate our magnanimous Imam, who opened this path to us and who brought guidance to the people of the country, with His friends, with the great guides, who have come throughout history, with the prophets and with the Imams, alayhim as-salam, and that He will bestow success on you as well. The subjects discussed by the gentlemen, the suggestions and requests they put forward, are primarily related to the executive organizations. These should be submitted to them, but I will ask them to pursue the matter. You too should pursue the matter as well. I will do the same. May God's greetings, mercy and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.